And now, here's Bill Resnick with his guest, Mark Weisbrot, to discuss the UK elections. Bill.
Thanks, Clayton. Hi, Mark. Welcome to KBOO.
Bill, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Mark Weisbrot, he's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He writes books, including Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. He co-authored with Dean Baker the book Social Security, The Phony Crisis. He produces lots of articles and op-eds that appear nearly everywhere. He also does frequent TV and radio appearances, especially likes to do independent listener-supported progressive stations like KBOO. And to top it off, he is also president of the organization Just Foreign Policy. Mark, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn and a British Labour Party, that is Corbyn's wing of it, is really amazing and inspiring, something like Bernie Sanders' story, but even less expected, and in fact on a far more radical and democratic, unapologetic democratic program. Mark, tell us about merry old England for the last many years and how Corbyn and his working class supporters have so shaken things up.
Well, I think a lot of it is that he was able to get his message out, you know, the in this last election. Part of the problem is that UK has a much more powerful right-wing media than we have in the U.S. So it's true that the media here didn't give Bernie Sanders much attention in the race, especially as compared to Trump, ironically, because they didn't like him at all either. But in the UK, they really did a campaign of character assassination against Corbyn. And, of course, he had all these people in his party who were against him as well and trying to get rid of him. But he survived, and he was able to get his message out, partly because of the Labour Manifesto, a document that they put out a couple months ago, which was, you know, a strong platform that was proposing expansion of the National Health Service, government-sponsored child care, expansion of labor rights, and things that people really wanted. And so that, I think, showed that it was the media's assassination of his character that was holding him down, not that the country wasn't ready for the kind of things that he wanted. And the other thing, of course, is that beginning in May, because it's official campaign period, according to law, they have to have TV coverage, has to give equal coverage to both sides or to the major parties. And so that helped him as well.
Yeah, Bert, he also, you know, he was sort of this rumpled guy from working class origins and a Labour Party, long Labour Party district in England, a backbencher, a critic. In the campaign, he began fumbling as he was always characterized, and then suddenly he became my understanding is, and reading some of the speeches and the debates that he had with the Conservative Party representatives, and he became a powerful stump speecher. He had these responses to conservative claims that just blew them out of the water. He was extremely sort of affable and successful and energetic. It was quite amazing, it seems to me, how people...
Well, I think he was always, pretty good. I've met him a couple times over the years, and I thought he was, I've seen him speak, and I thought he's very good. He's not the kind that, he doesn't make these really powerful, emotional speeches, but he's, he's very clear, and he inspires people. In fact, this was, I guess, should put this first. I mean, this was also the product of a mass movement, like the Bernie campaign, and probably bigger, and young people especially, that revived the Labour Party in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I read the manifesto just this morning, actually. I found it sort of shockingly radical in a way that Bernie's, as critical and thoughtful and progressive as Bernie was in the U.S. context, it didn't mince any words. It stood for public goods. It was renationalizing the railroads that people want. It was rejuvenating and reversing all the cuts in the National Health Service. It talked about nationalizing the electricity distribution system and setting up cooperatives for energy supply that is challenging all the investor-owned utilities and re-regulating them, and more. In fact, I mean, it was quite amazing, protecting pensions, raising pensions, building public housing. I mean, it sounds impossible, of course, and almost absurd to think that the conservative neoliberal system would accept anything like that. And yet the people of England seemed to think that this was a lot of great ideas. It was, I thought, you know, there was no mincing words in that platform.
No, that's right. And obviously he wouldn't be able to get all these things. Although, you know, the popular vote was pretty close. I think it was like 42 to 40
right.
for the Tories. And if, as what, you know, going forward, if the Tories are unable to form a stable government, and there are a number of people who think that that's a likely outcome, actually, in the next few months, if they have another election, I think he's got the Labour has a very good chance of winning. So this is, you know, this is what the Labour Party used to be before the Thatcher era. And it was very similar in a lot of ways to the U.S., it's just that they were always more left, say, than the Democratic Party here. But you had the same transformation. You know, you had new labor, neoliberal, putting forth a neoliberal program.
Right, Clinton and Tony Blair.
Iraq War was another thing. You know, that's the one of the things that I emphasize, is that he was so honest about the whole war on terror. He said publicly, after the Manchester attacks, he said that that the UK's interventions in other countries, and of course he was against all the wars, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan.
But he did have a program for dealing with terrorism as a domestic criminal threat. It wasn't that he was going to be soft on it or somehow or excuse it.
No, that's right. But he emphasized what people really need to know, that this is a result of U.S. and U.K. intervention in other countries. It's not, and that's, you know, something that most people are afraid to say, especially when they're running for office. So this was a very important part as well. And of course, there's millions of people there who know this. In fact, the majority of the country knows this, according to recent polls, but no one will say it. And, you know, people appreciate the honesty and integrity. It was the same with Bernie, right? He's been saying the same thing for 30 years. Everybody knows he means it. Neither one of these guys has any whiff of corruption or, you know, self-interest even in what they're doing. And so it's a populist revolt that's going on all over the place. It's just some places where the left is too weak, you see for other reasons, you see this right-wing populism, or this phony right-wing populism that you have in the case of Donald Trump, is able to squeak by. But mostly, this is the direction, I think, that Europe is going to go, because, you know, even in France, Mélenchon, in the first round of the presidential election in France, you had a left candidate who came within 1.3 percentage points of making it into the second round.
No, with 20% of the vote. Let me do a station.
He had the same program as Jeremy, really.
Right. Let me do a station ID, and then we'll get back to the implications for the entire planet, but especially, I think, for Southern Europe, in fact. Let's get back to that. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mark Weisbrot, who writes a lot of books and articles, and he's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're talking about Jeremy Corbyn and the immense eruption in England against conservative. Actually, it's not just Brexit, the opposition to basically neoliberalism and a strong call for a government for the few and not the many, which is the that was Corbyn and the Labour Party's slogan during the election, for the few and not the many. Tell us about the implications for Europe and the world of Corbyn's ascent and popularity. And then we can get into the problem of governance if he, in fact, ever you mentioned it, it's not impossible that Corbyn will win a majority in the next year, and after that, maybe. In any event, there are real possibilities, but then what would happen? So first the implications, and then we'll talk about the problem of governing capitalism.
Well, the story, I mean, there is a common story in Europe. Obviously, the situation is really different in each country. And the Eurozone, the 19 countries that are in the Eurozone, have a special problem of not being able to control their most important economic policies. And so that's the toughest of all. I mean, you know, it's kind of ironic that UK was the first to vote to leave the European Union when they were less constrained than France or Italy or Spain or any of the countries in the Eurozone, because they have their own central bank and their own currency, and that has helped them. I mean, their unemployment is relatively low right now, like ours. On the other hand, there are plenty of other problems that people are angry about. You know, wages are not growing, productivity hasn't grown for practically a decade. And
but insecurity has enormously grown all over the world.
That's right. A lot of economic insecurity, and of course, a lot of people displaced by so-called globalization. And so you have those problems as well. But the big problem is, I think, the whole neoliberal set of policies. By that, I mean, you know, governments not willing to use the basic macroeconomic policies to pursue full employment, and in fact, in the Eurozone countries, going in the opposite direction and keeping unemployment twice the level as it is here in the United States. So I think that's what everybody is facing, is how to deal with that. And in the UK, of course, the Labour Party put forward a straightforward program that prioritizes reducing unemployment. Mélenchon did the same thing in France. The Syriza party did something similar in Greece, but then they were kind of crushed by the European authorities. And because they wouldn't leave the euro, they're basically stuck right now in this 7-year depression. I mean, the economy is starting to recover a little right now, but all the Eurozone has a problem of mass unemployment that, even with the slow kind of economic recovery that could happen, you won't get. You're basically condemning a whole generation to either being jobless or, you know, a large part of them,
right,
or leaving the country.
Yeah, even though the neoliberal domination and the way, in fact, they're just squeezing working people to maintain this immense and growing financial apparatus. What happens if Corbyn or Mélenchon, or, I mean, we don't want to see a repeat of Syriza, but in fact, the capital has such power now, and it happened in England with Harold Wilson, and then the Brown government, Mitterrand in France. They made attempts to actually reflate the economy and create jobs, but and tax the wealthy to some extent, and capital, in fact, went on strike, basically, or flight, or made it impossible for them to govern, raised unemployment rates, and they became seen as, in fact, undermining even the weak economies that were then existing. How do you, in 30 seconds, Mark, deal with that question?
Well, I don't think you have the same thing. You would have the same thing today. I think that countries could, I mean, look at Brexit. Everybody, the IMF and all the newspapers, everybody said that they were going to have a terrible shock from Brexit, and it didn't happen. And, you know, that was leaving the EU, which is, you know, quite a big thing. And so, no, I don't think that any of these countries, if they wanted to change their policies, you know, you would have a shock at first, like you know, especially if you're leaving the euro, you have a new currency, and you would have a crisis, but then that wouldn't turn into this like 7-year depression that you have in Greece. It would recover, and then they'd be able to control their economic policy.
That's
okay.
Boy, I wish I could share that optimism. You know. Anyway, Mark, thanks so much for talking to us.
Sure, thank you.
Right, so long.
Bye-bye.